Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode of Seriously. It's been a pretty big day for us so far. We're recording this on Monday. You might already have an idea of what I'm about to say, but let's just say that if you work at a weekly political magazine, what's going on in the political culture really dominates how you spend your time. If there, say, is a revelation in a biography that's being serialised in a newspaper that maybe the Prime Minister allegedly put his penis in a dead pig's mouth when he was a student, this changes your plan for how you're going to spend your time.
Oh my god. I mean, usually Caroline and I try and like use Seriously as a way to escape the political aspect of our job, but today there's no escaping it. When you like, I was going to bed last night and I got, this is how I heard the news, I'm not sure about you, I got a text that was an emoji of a pig's face, an emoji of a top hat, and like a shocked face. And I was like, my first thought was like Black Mirror, you know, that Mirror episode.
The way everyone's dealing with this is through the prism of pop culture, right?
Yeah. Because
immediately Twitter was just full of people going, what did Charlie Brooker know when he wrote that episode of Black Mirror where the Prime Minister ends up having to have sex with a pig?
Yeah, although in that Black Mirror episode, there are extreme circumstances that force the Prime Minister into having sex with a pig.
Well, he's basically doing it to like save a member of the royal family.
Yeah, it's
from
like Kate Middleton,
situation. Yeah.
whereas... If rumours are to be believed, our Prime Minister did it purely recreationally, which is hilarious and awful.
Allegedly as part of a drinking society thing when he was at Oxford. And judging by the men who've come out writing op-eds today being like, what? It's not that bad.
We were all young once. Pigs' heads abound. What are you going to do?
It's pretty much the preserve of a very particular kind of student. Incidentally, because I went to Oxford University as well, and I had no idea any of this was a thing. I'd never even heard of the society until yesterday. But I do remember there being a butcher in the covered market that always had pig's heads
absolutely
on display.
That was my first thought too.
And now I'm wondering why that was. I assumed it was for soup.
Yeah, I was there as well, and I can absolutely guarantee that no human that I socialised with ever thought that it would be a good idea to put any part of their body, genital or otherwise, inside the mouth of a dead pig.
No, nor had the opportunity ever arisen.
Absolutely bizarre, and something we're just trying to incorporate into our day-to-day life. I actually find it a hilarious story.
Yeah,
even though I'm like vegetarian and like hate the thought of it, I still think
it's funny. I'm thinking that I'm over it, that I've become cynical about it. The transition for me from initial shock at finding something out to cynicism about it, the distance just gets shorter all the time. I just get more and more jaded about these things. And I keep thinking, I'm over this, that this is now passé to me, and then I remember it again and then just have a little private laugh to myself because I'm still so happy about it.
And the jokes just keep coming, like the whole issue with Ed Miliband being like scuppered for Prime Minister of this country because he ate a bacon sandwich sloppily and someone took a photo and it looked embarrassing. I just keep thinking of, where is Ed Miliband right now? How happy is he on a scale of 1 to 10? It's just so good.
I hope he's happy.
I know.
Hope he's happy.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, I, I found out in a really bizarre way, which was that, as previously discussed, I love Downton Abbey and I was watching it last night. And at 10:30 when it finished, I obviously went on Twitter immediately to see what other people were saying about it. And instead of finding lots of people making snarky remarks about the Dowager Countess, I found lots and lots of pictures of David Cameron holding a pig, because by that point the story had been out for long enough that Twitter had moved past the initial statement of what had happened into like the jokes about the jokes about the jokes. So I'm like, why is everyone posting that picture of David Cameron like just cradling a pig in his arms?
I know.
Has David Cameron like adopted a pig instead of a cat? And so I had to scroll back quite far to find what the hell was going on.
It's so funny. What it made me remember was when that Black Mirror episode was being trailed, there were posters and it just said, a prime minister should do anything for his country. And then there's this pig in a spotlight in the dark. And you see that poster and like, maybe I'm some just like sick individual, but my first thought is like, really? Is the prime minister going to have sex with a pig? And I have no idea why that's your first thought or why it was mine anyway. But the same thing happened with this, where like people, I was reading pig prime minister and I was like, no. No, like, this can't be happening, can it? And, like, it seems like it's just going to blow over and he's probably going to be fine, which is, like, the worst thing about it.
Yeah, well, you know, so his statement is that he's not even going to dignify this with a response. He's not even bothering to deny it.
Which, as someone pointed out to me, is what Bridget Jones does when she's lying.
Another excellent example of using pop culture to understand this scandal. Our colleague Stephen Bush, who's written about it this morning, said that it pretty much surely priced in that posh people do like weird sex things. This is not really that shocking if you think about it.
It's pretty weird.
It's pretty weird, but I mean in the kind of political context.
It's a dark, dark day, but I am absolutely loving it at the same time.
So yeah.
There's no easy way to transition.
I was gonna say, we are now going to stop talking about this and start talking about some films and stuff.
There is absolutely no like pig sex in the rest of the entire podcast.
Which
you'll
is
be
a
relieved
good thing,
to hear,
listeners. So on with that. The first thing we're going to talk about today is the film 45 Years, which we've seen in the last couple of weeks, which is I think still out in cinemas, and you can also get it online. It's available on Blinkbox and stuff to rent. Which is a film that stars Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay as a couple just coming up to celebrating their 45-year wedding anniversary. So they've been married a really long time. They are that kind of level of comfortable with each other that only happens when you know someone that well and have lived with them for that long. It covers the week running up to their anniversary party. And I think on the Monday, the husband, played by Tom Courtenay, gets this phone call to say that a girlfriend of his from more than 45 years ago, who died tragically in a mountaineering accident when they were hiking in Switzerland, her body has been found preserved perfectly in the ice of a glacier.
This really is a great venue for an anniversary. So full of history, you see. Like a good marriage.
What is it?
They found her. You know who I'm talking about, don't you?
We never talked about it in all the years that we've known each other.
And it's tainted everything.
And this just knocks their whole world out of orbit, really. And so the film is about how they cope with this idea of withholding and giving information, how it makes them think about their relationship, and then ultimately what happens at the party.
Mm. And it's sort of about the idea of like what happens when ghosts from your past like manage to re-enter a relationship that they were never like really part of in the first place. It's funny that you say about them being so comfortable with each other, because I think it's really interesting how the film's called 45 Years, and it's obviously about this like great long stretch of time, but it very intentionally takes place over a week. So you have the 7 days, and it starts, is it the Sunday before the Saturday of the party?
Yeah.
And the premise sort of begins with the idea of their party preparations, and this event comes in and intrudes and disrupts that. And so you get a real sense of like the longevity of their relationship only through these this fairly routine. It's not a routine week for them, but you know, you see them moving through all their routines, their friends. They've got a very sort of isolated domestic life that's based mainly on their relationship as a couple, because they have no children.
And they live in a sort of remote, I think it's Norfolk, isn't it? Very flat near the Broads.
It's beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Stunningly shot.
And that landscape really is a part of the film, because Kate, the woman in it played by Charlotte Rampling, you know, she walks the dog every morning.
Lovely dog. Big
really
Alsatian.
Lovely dog.
Yeah.
And the dog is really important, because later on she sort of says, I wish we had more more pictures. I wish we had more photos. I guess because we didn't have children, we didn't really feel the need to document each other doing stuff.
Mm.
And he says, well, what would you like to have pictures of? And she names the dogs they've had and said, well, you know, Tessa when she was little.
Yeah.
You know, which is both self-consciously, yeah, our dog, I guess, is kind of a surrogate for our child, but also I just really like our dog.
Yeah.
You know? But there's a real kind of bittersweetness to the film. Did you enjoy it, do you think?
Well, I went when I was feeling a bit miserable, and you know when you're a bit tired and you're like, I'm just gonna go to the cinema and like sit in a dark room, and if something makes me cry, that'll just be a nice release for me. So I was kind of in the right headspace, I think, to enjoy it as a film. I love Charlotte Rampling and she was brilliant in it. In fact, the whole cast I think were really excellent, because this is a film that very much relies on very subtle parts of an interaction that have a lot more going on beneath them. There's not very many very open conversations about what this ex-girlfriend whose body's been discovered means for their relationship. It's all very much deeper than that in terms of how the film is shot, and that means that the performances have to be really, really good to support that, and they are.
Yeah, because not only have you got Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay in the main roles, you've got Geraldine James as sort of main best friend.
Yeah.
She's really great as well. Mm-hmm. And also, as you say, just the style of how it's shot is very much about static long shots. So if you can't fill the screen with your face and what's happening on your face, then the film wasn't going to work.
Exactly. In its own way, it's a very dramatic film. It's weirdly quite melodramatic.
I found it quite stressful to watch.
Nothing really happens in terms of, like, there's no real grand reveals. It all is very ambiguous. And the real moments of, like, emotional trauma in it tend to be either through very austere conversations or factual conversations between the two main characters in bed, or, you know, moments where Kate is alone. So one of the most emotional scenes in the film is when she finds some pictures in the loft that her husband has sort of set up on a projector, some old slides with a sheet up there, so she can tell he's kind of been up there and been looking at them. And she flicks through all these, the pictures of the girl before she died. And, you know, that's a moment where she's only interacting with a screen, as it were, and it's just, but it's so raw and painful to watch, and it's very theatrical almost.
Yeah, and it plays into this idea that when you've been with someone that long, what is there left to talk about?
Yeah.
And the answer is everything.
Yeah, and some things that are actually maybe too painful to even comprehend and talk about.
Yeah, and I actually found myself down on Tom Courtenay's character by the end, because it's not like he didn't tell his wife about this girlfriend he had before he met her. As soon as he said, when he got the news, as he said they found Catcher, Kate knew exactly who he meant. Like, so she knew of her existence, and she knew that it was a previous relationship of his, and she knew about the tragic accident. But he told her just enough to make her feel like she knew everything. Mm. When actually what comes out, at least to the viewer, if not to her, is that he withheld important information from her. So like he is eventually pressured into revealing that if Katja hadn't died, they definitely would have got married. You see, apologies if this is a spoiler,
it is a big spoiler, yeah.
She sees on those slides that Katja was pregnant.
Yeah, and that's obviously a huge deal when they've decided, we're not really sure why, and presumably these have been for their own reasons, but they've decided not to have children. So to see somebody pregnant with her husband's unborn child must be so extreme for her.
So extreme. And then you've got all of the symbolism of this woman and the child have been kind of perfectly preserved, frozen in this glacier for 50 years.
The life that could have been.
And you feel so much like the reason why her husband, Jeff, is behaving kind of weirdly about it, being very closed off and very sort of mysterious about his emotions to do with it, is partly because of the way she died and the way her body's been found. If she died in a car accident and then there'd been a funeral, you sort of feel like he wouldn't be so stuck on it. But
yeah,
the bits you get of his personality, he is sensible of the symbolism. You can tell, like the bit where she teases him for having yet another go at trying to read Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
You know, he is someone who thinks about things and he can feel the symbolism of it.
Yeah, and she finds a flower that he's tried to preserve in a diary from their walk.
Mm.
Yeah, it's all very thick with that kind of thing.
And it's a compelling film. I would absolutely watch it again, I think.
Mm.
Not least because it's got that sort of revelation about the pregnancy that comes about 2/3 of the way through, maybe. Mm. I would watch it in the way that a book that's got a big revelation in it, you almost want to go back to the beginning and read it again now that you know.
Yeah, you want to go back and read what Wickham said again because it's all going to be different.
Now you know he's evil. Yeah, exactly. So I want to watch it again.
So that's an unfair comparison for the husband in this film, but yeah.
And as you say, Charlotte Rampling is completely excellent in it, as she is in all things. Oh, I wish I could remember who'd written this, but someone in reviewing it said that she has the most inscrutable face in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that was just absolutely perfect for this film, because the reason I got quite stressed out when I was watching it was because I really wanted to know how she felt, but her face wasn't telling me.
Yeah, exactly. I also kept thinking that something terrible might happen. It's like very ominous in that you think, oh my God, is someone else going to die? I don't know.
I was convinced he was going to run off to Switzerland.
Yeah, and not go to the party and things like that. There's a real sense of dread in it the whole way through, which did make it quite stressful to watch.
But what really made my sort of heart clench at the end was the fact that he didn't do that. And actually, he makes really quite a sweet speech at the party. He gets very emotional about how much he loves her and how much he values her. And then there's this very ambiguous ending where the camera kind of lingers on her face while they're dancing.
And it really undercuts all the sweetness of the ceremony beforehand.
And you just get the feeling that she is now reconsidering her whole life in light of what's happened this week.
But that for me was a really interesting moment, because that is a trope, maybe trope's too strong a word, but a feature of so many films that I find very teenage, where you have someone lost in the music, as it were, and really relating to the lyrics and it changing their perspective on the world. And this is something that I feel like always happens in films, where like the uncool kid goes to a party and he's listening to a song about like letting your fears go and, you know, embracing life. It was like that, but reversed, and obviously with a much older protagonist. And I can't quite remember the lyrics. The
song's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is obviously a metaphor, because he's been, you know, obscuring her vision of the past for 45 years.
And the way that he's really like singing the words so emphatically is kind of what catches her off guard. And it's like, oh my God, what are you actually saying in this moment?
And I sympathise with it so strongly that it would almost have been less traumatic for her if he had just left her and gone to Switzerland.
Yeah.
Because at least that's a kind of clean cut. That's like an amputation. Whereas this, on the surface, he does everything that she wants of him, which is that, you know, he helps with the party preparations, he goes to the party.
Puts
a nice suit on. He is lovely to all their friends. He gives this amazing speech about how much he loves her. And then when they're as you say, when they're dancing and she's listening to him sing these words and she's going, and yet there's still things that
there's a disconnect here.
You're holding back from me. And the fact that you've done this superficially while still holding something of yourself back from me is
it's like more
worse.
Deadening, yeah. 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 It's like we're the frozen people.
We are the people in the glacier, and you are never ever going to explain to me.
It's not a great jolly of a film, but it's really brilliantly done, I think.
And it's really beautiful, as you say. I don't know if there's a name for this genre yet, but it's definitely, in my mind, emerging as a thing. British cinema are starting to make films aimed at older people.
Yeah.
So this is obviously a really good example. Also Quartet from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Also starred Tom Courtenay and Maggie Smith and Billy Connolly. Ditto the adaptation of S.E.O. Trot. It's never too late, you know.
Yeah.
It's never too late to actually act on your feelings.
You know?
It's just a no-brainer that retired people, older people, obviously they go to the cinema and
see films.
Yeah, I
was the youngest person in my screening by far.
So why wouldn't they want... Oh, of course, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel is another really famous example. Why wouldn't they want to see things relevant to them, characters like them?
Especially with these enormous stars who people will go and see regardless of what they're doing. Like, I will see anything if Maggie Smith's in it because it's Maggie Smith.
I read something about there's also a really interesting technological shift happening. So 45 years, as well as being on fairly limited release in cinemas, is also available on the day of cinematic release, was also available as a download or to rent online, which is how I watched it.
That's a very deliberate decision.
And it's also brilliant that, I mean, I've been as guilty of this as anyone, as assuming that obviously my great uncle can't get his newspaper subscription on an iPad. How on earth is he ever going to work on an iPad? He's never even had a mobile phone. Of course he can do it. He loves it. He's really into it. So it's really, really patronising to assume that just because people are old doesn't mean that they can't use their smart TVs as well as anyone else. And so finally the market is going, well, not only can they use their smart TVs, they want to use them. And actually,
maybe they'd prefer to use that than to travel and go to the cinema.
And perhaps they're also from a time and a culture that is more likely to want to pay for things.
Yeah.
So if we give them the opportunity to do so, they will.
And if you live somewhere like, you know, in the Norfolk Broads somewhere, it works better, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's an interesting conversation happening around the film, as well as the film itself being wonderful. I've no idea whether it'll win any awards, but you just feel like
I hope
it should.
So. I mean, I think for performances more than anything, because I think all the cast were so strong. I'd love to see Charlotte Rampling win something for that.
Yes. I've also seen people praising the way the film is edited. And I know literally nothing about the technology of that, but you can just tell the length of the shots and the way they're very few, but the way the cuts are made is very, very clever and very sort of always serving your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And structurally, again, I think it was really successful in the way that it managed to compress such a long period of time with such intensity into the space of literally 7 days. I thought that worked amazingly.
So there you have it. Not our cheeriest ever recommendation, but absolutely an excellent film.
They asked me how I knew my true love was true.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is This Is England, the film, the series that came after, because on Channel 4 at the moment, they've just started airing This Is England 90. So This Is England is a Shane Meadows film that follows the sort of subculture of like skinheads in the early 80s, and then sort of exploring the race element of that and power dynamics between different factions of the subculture. And then it went on to become several, this is the third, am I right, TV series?
Yes, so they've done 86, 88 and 90, I think. The numbers referring to the years in which they're set.
It follows all the same characters through the years. When I heard about this, I was thinking, my God, they must all be like 85 now, like they would be if Downton Abbey followed a proper timeline. but actually, it's only about 10 years max, isn't it? Because it's the early 80s when the first film is set. So I have like heard so much about This Is England and for some reason still hadn't watched it. So I watched the film and the first episode of the new series. So I kind of like skipped like an entire decade and probably ruined that experience for myself, but I loved the movie so much. I was like, why has it taken me so long to watch this? It's so good. I was chatting to some friends about it. None of us had seen it, and we were all talking about like, oh, is that that film that's really like glorifying that sort of like 80s vision of what England is? You know, everyone who's seen the film will know that that's exactly the opposite of what it's doing. It's really
deconstructing that idea.
Exactly. It's a quite sort of look at all the problems with doing that.
Yes, I totally agree that the film, I think, is the pinnacle of the series. And then I think it just gets less good. Partly that's, I think, to do with familiarity with the style and subject matter, and partly because I think it sort of loses its way a little bit. I've also seen the This Is England 86, the first TV series, and that I do think is really excellent. I really like how it seems odd to use the phrase well plotted about something that sort of deliberately doesn't have a massive amount of plot, but how sort of tightly written the episodes are. So I'm thinking particularly the first episode of This Is England 86 is about a wedding. Everything in it, even if you don't realise it initially, is to do with the wedding. So the arguments that someone's having with their parents at the beginning is subsequently shown to be because they don't want to come to the wedding. There's this amazing bit where two of them are prowling around a graveyard, and then they get in a fight with this elderly black woman who's putting some flowers on a grave, and you realise that what they're doing is they're trying to steal flowers, but like fresh ones. And the reason they're doing this is because they're going to a wedding and they haven't got any money. And God. So they want something to take to the wedding. But you don't realise that for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You're just like, why are these boys like shouting at this poor woman in a graveyard? And then they're trying to run away from her and she chases them, and it's kind of blackly comic.
Yeah.
Everything's pointing towards this one event, even if you don't initially realise it. So I really admire it as like a feat of writing.
Well, that's how I felt watching the film too, because it's so amazing, I think, on like a character level. So you're introduced to this like 14-year-old kid, 13 maybe, who's sort of being picked on for having a bad outfit. And then he happens to run into this group of older boys sitting under a bridge in a tunnel sort of thing.
I've been picked on 3 times today.
Woodstock that way, pal.
Who's picking on you, love?
Harvey.
Harvey?
I've got one of those for you. My name is Harvey.
And they sort of tease him too, but they're so warm with it and they really invite him to sort of just be a part of their gang for no real reason. So there's this really sort of nice mix of the feeling of them being like a gang. Although it's a fairly sort of hyper-masculine environment, they're all like very sensitive, very loving and warm until someone they used to know who's been in prison for a while comes back and really brings this like intense nationalist, racist view of what their culture means, what that skinhead subculture means, and, you know, starts bringing along a St. George's Cross and taking everyone to like National Front rallies.
People who work hard are welcome open arms in this country.
Sean, are you okay?
It's the people who think we owe them a living that need to go back.
And it all gets, you know, very, very nasty very, very quickly. Woody, who's sort of the leader of the gang before this guy comes in and kind of ruins everything, is trying to like keep everything from collapsing around.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tim, but it's not until there's a full-on, awful-to-watch, serious racist attack that the people who have been charmed and impressed by this guy, including the youngest kid, who's obviously the most impressionable, fall away from it. And it's really, really interesting in a very subtle way on like how the skinhead movement was really influenced by like West Indian culture and like reggae and ska.
But then turned against the people that they were sort of holding up,
And just before that violent racist attack, you see the leader of the of that racist part of the culture being really conflicted. I don't think he's doing it to wind him up to this black guy who's one of the gang. Like, yeah, I love your music. I love everything about, you know, your culture. I'd love to come round to your grands for ackee and saltfish. And then literally, because of his own like daddy issues, he has this incredibly racialized rage that he can't handle and just like attacks him. It's really well done because at no point is it ever sympathetic in a way that makes you think like, oh, we should understand why this poor guy is racist. Like, obviously the tone of the film is like, this guy's a bad guy and this is an awful, awful thing that's happening. But it really like gets to the nitty gritty of it. And it's sort of a film that's saying like, well, why is white culture the way it is? Why is there this like violent strain that can enter white culture? Why as white people can we be white supremacist? And it's like really clever.
It's really clever. And it's also so rare, as you say, it's a discussion of race focused primarily on whiteness that isn't overbearing or patronizing or
or assumes whiteness as the norm or whiteness as blankness. It's really saying like this is an active force and it's oppressing people.
Let's unpick it and see how and why it is like it is. Yeah, so it is excellent on that front.
That's presumably quite hard to maintain going forward with the like new generations and the series that unfold after it.
Yes, it becomes less about race and more so in 86 a lot of it is about kind of unemployment and what happens if you've been a skinhead and then you grow up. So like there's a bit I remember where Woody is grappling with this idea that actually what he really wants in life is to like move to the suburbs and start eating olives. And he's really conflicted about like
he's
what is
so
this,
well drawn as
what
a character.
Does this say about me now that this is what I want? And like the wedding in the first one is his and Lowell's wedding. His parents turn up, I think, even though they haven't invited them, they turn up. And it gets to the kind of crucial moment of him needing to say, I do, and he doesn't. And there's just like a really, really long silence. And then sort of luckily for him, very unluckily for the character involved, one of the other characters is found to be having a heart attack in the loos. And so the whole wedding is like postponed while they take him to the hospital and stuff. But when he's arguing with Lowell about it later, he's like, I just saw my parents there and I was like, do we want to end up like them? And so he's really oppressed by this idea that we were part of a counterculture and now we seem to be joining the very thing that we were counter to. So that's more of a theme, I think, going on. And then obviously the series that's on at the moment, This Is England 90, is much more... I saw Paul Mason had written a long essay for The Guardian about the idea that the people featured in the most recent series are the last example of a pre-digital white working class.
Right, yeah.
Which is an interesting definition of them as a group that I hadn't really thought of. Mm-hmm. But these were people who, despite being part of Britain's majority in racial terms, were economically very marginalised. And just as everything was going great in the City of London and everyone was making money hand over fist, etc., etc., because they don't have kind of digital connectivity to any of that, they're just sort of mouldering away, it feels like.
As we were saying at the beginning, it's funny that that phrase, This Is England, which is used, the title comes from one of these speeches about why we shouldn't have immigrants in the country, blah, 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 is very sort of bitterly ironic. But when we get to This Is England 90, for me, it feels much more imbued with like nostalgia and much more about like, oh, remember the 90s when everyone had bucket hats and everything was like,
yeah,
we know sunshine. We were down on our luck, but we had a great time and we went to raves and we listened to the same
raves
roses.
And fields and stuff. Yeah, it does.
The opening really brought that home to me because the first episode starts with Gadget, one of the gang from right back in the beginning, Milk, are trying to get free school dinners from Lol, who works in a school canteen. And they're talking about, oh, the reason we come and get school dinners is not because it's free. It's because school dinners bring something back for you, don't they? They're so nostalgic. Mm. We want this food because it reminds us of like a better time and when we were all young and we were all having loads of fun and nothing mattered. And for me, I was like, so is This Is England 90 the equivalent of a school dinner for us? Is that what this show is doing?
Yeah, so there is a sense that it started to incorporate the nostalgia that it was reacting
at
against.
The beginning, yeah.
I suppose you could say that that's part of its characters growing older, that people just romanticise what was in the past. There's a phrase that I use all the time. The critic Raymond Williams once wrote, nostalgia is the act of using the past as a stick to beat the present, which seems relevant here. But at the same time, it's possibly also just a disease of a long-running series of anything.
Also, watching that first film, it did make me think that it was probably still very relevant today because so much of it seemed to be about like the idea of borders and like asserting borders and how borders are always going to be inherently violent in some way. And until you like open yourself up to the idea that like people should be able to like move between countries, but also between groups and like this idea that until people feel free to move fluidly, people are always going to be violent to each other. And obviously the immigration rhetoric made me think of the refugee crisis
course,
at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And that last shot where he throws the St. George's cross into the sea, for me, I was like, wow, that's a really bold statement even now. That's a real bold rejection of an idea of like a closed border. Although I understand that the movement of the show means that it has to move away from some extent to what it was originally about, because otherwise it just becomes, you know, beating a dead horse. I do think it could still be pulling at stuff.
I am going to make a sweeping generalisation now about the kind of people who I see talking about This Is England and how much they love it. They are by and large people who enjoy the nostalgia aspect of it. And so it is catering to that. I don't know. I feel like it's popular, particularly with critics, people in their 30s who perhaps lived a similar kind of life or feel like they came from a background close to when they've now sort of made it and they're in the media, etc., etc. And what Shane Meadows has done has make this sort of perfect seeming product that enables them to package up their own past.
Yeah, exactly. And although I really enjoyed it, I have to say I like loved seeing the characters in their like new lives. I missed that toughness and that sharp eye and the bitterness from the first movie.
Yeah, and I did also actually, so I rewatched some of This England 86 for our discussion today, and there's this bit where Sean, isn't it, the boy?
Yeah,
so he's quite involved in a complicated plot with some bullies at his school that has resulted in him getting a fairly serious bang on the head, and he's like bleeding partly down his head, but he's decided, oh, I'm fine, I can walk, I'm gonna try and go home. So he's walking along a kind of, it's probably an A road, it's like a single file but fairly major road, and there's not a path, but there's like a kind of rubbish grassy verge, and he's walking along this verge and he just falls over at one point, and he's just like lying on the rubbish grass. And I mean, not the head wound, but that is something that I did when I was a teenager. Like, it's not dissimilar to the place where I live, and one time I tried to walk like from like a concert back to my school or something, and it was too far and I walked the wrong way. And I remember I just tripped and I fell in this grassy verge, and all these cars were going past, and I was just like, my life is awful. Like, I'm 14 and I don't know where I am, and I'm on a, like, it's not even proper grass, it's like scrub and dust. This is awful. So just seeing him do that, I was like, no, this is England. Being a teenager and like lying in some dirt and having cars go past you on an A road.
Yeah.
So that made me weirdly nostalgic, even though that was horrible.
I mean, for me as well, we've talked about this before, I feel like, but those sort of council houses, the like pebble dash council houses with big plasticky windows, white bordered windows. Oh, for me, that just pulls at my heartstrings. So it's just like round where I grew up. That was just the look of everywhere.
But those are the details that are consistently brilliant throughout, I think. Well written, and also just the production design and everything is so minutely accurate.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people connect to it in the way they have.
Absolutely.
Even if, I don't know, I wouldn't fully identify myself as a fan of it. I have a lot of time for it.
I'm definitely, I think, going to become a fan of it. I'm going to go and watch 86 especially.
Brilliantly. They're all on, this is also, I learned this weekend, it's not called 4OD anymore.
Oh, what's
it called? It's called All 4.
Oh, All 4. Actually, yeah, I have the
and
app.
It's much better. It works a lot better. Yeah. But they're all on it.
Cool. Well, that's, you know, the rest of my life sorted.
Ding ding, digga digga ding, a flong a flong, a dink a flong ding dong.
On to the part of the podcast where we recommend each other things. Caroline, last week I recommended you the glittery, shambolic tent fest that is the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus.
You've heard of Oxford Circus? You've heard of Piccadilly Circus? And this is the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, and we've got sights and sounds and marbles to delight your eyes and ears.
How did you get along?
I don't even know how to describe my reaction to it. I was so conflicted, because I should say at the beginning of this that I'm not only am I not a Rolling Stones fan, I feel like even that statement I'm not qualified to make, because I haven't even listened to enough of their music to be able to determine if I like it or not.
Yeah, that inevitably you will know several Rolling Stones songs.
I'm sure I do. But I probably couldn't name them, and I don't know which ones they are. It's just not music I've ever really encountered.
It's also one of those bands where it's quite easy to be like, yeah, I know Brown Sugar, or I know Sympathy for the Devil, but I've never sat down and like heard an album by the Rolling Stones. I've got no idea what that would sound like.
No, never have. I think partly because it's just not music my parents were ever into, so it never got passed down that way, whereas they were massively into the Beatles, and so I know words about
exactly,
that.
Whereas my dad and his friend were big Stones fans, so
I'd never heard some of the songs that they were playing in it, and I only had the vaguest idea of even like what they looked like. So on seeing this, it was like a kind of Technicolor explosion in my mind of, oh, so this is what the 60s was about.
It is like the 60s. I mean, the 60s was already on acid, but it's like the 60s on acid. Like
on acid and on like the, I don't know, the colours in it.
Yeah.
Were what just, I kept coming back to, I guess because I'm used to seeing photography from that time that is black and white or sort of sepia or very muted. Seeing this like really, really strongly contrasty coloured film where, like, you can see Mick Jagger's burgundy flares really vividly. And I don't know, somehow it just seemed almost like, you know those...
They're cord, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, they're, like... they're really weird trousers. And they're so tight.
Yeah, see everything.
But it made me think, weirdly, of, you know, in the 19th century...
What is
so it was like early everything is about the 19th century with early photographs how yeah. they'd like, and actually way later than that, I've got a photograph of my grandmother from the Second World War that's done like this, where it was taken in black and white and then hand painted and the colours just look too real to be real, because you know that no actual film was that sensitive to colour at that time.
Yeah.
That's how I felt like this. It's like, has this been post-doctored to make it look more colourful?
But, yeah, because it's funny, those iconic photos you think about with the Rolling Stones tend to be from like maybe 64, 65, 66, and this is 69, so it's slightly later, and it is that they do all look a bit shaggier, a bit more glittery. And it's all a bit more luxurious, I think.
John Lennon, I suppose because I'm more familiar with the sort of Beatles output, the way John Lennon looked really situated it in time
for
me.
Yeah, because like, he's got the long hair
and the
aviators.
He's got the really long hair and the aviators, and he's like, his face is really thin and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't look like that at the beginning of the 60s.
No.
So yeah, no, I really enjoyed the music, mostly because they and their various collaborators and friends who were on as well were really good to watch. Like, not all musicians are interesting to look at, even if their music sounds good, but these guys really were.
Yeah, they're all like, so you're just like, man, what do your parties look like? This is so weird, and this is the bit that you're like preparing to show the cameras. Like, what's going on? And you're...
I was a bit confused about why all the women in the audience were sort of wearing ponchos.
This is what I think I said last week. Like, I don't know if they were, like, actual fans or, like, models that were cast, because they all seemed to, like, look the same, and they were all, like, the same age, and they were all really pretty.
They were all wearing sort of yellow things.
Yeah, and like, crochet, I seem to remember. But they all are, like, visibly emotional.
Oh, yeah.
And going nuts in a great way.
Yeah, no, that part of it was really great. If you do have a live DVD of a band, I like it if it includes cuts to the audience.
Oh, yeah.
That's the
best
bit.
Yeah, that's half the bit, yeah.
Even to the extent of listeners may or may not know that I am very into classical music and write about it for the New Statesman quite a lot. So I'm probably more familiar with like live performances of operas and stuff than I am of pop music. But there are some excellent live films of operas that Pavarotti are in where they do cutaways to the audience.
Tears
streaming down their face, or just looking really bored, or just having a reaction, or anything. Like, especially in operas where there's like comic arias that are very like wordplay based and stuff, they will cut to the audience laughing as if it's stand-up.
Oh, wow.
So I really love that in a kind of live film where you get that sense of the audience.
It looks tiny, doesn't it?
This can't be even like 200 people.
Yeah,
it's really small,
and there's no real like barriers between the audience and the stage and stuff, so it feels very like interaction-y. And all these little moments that are so weird. I have like several really like things that just have burnt into my memory from it. I remember when they perform Sympathy for the Devil, Mick takes his top off and he's like covered in like biro like biro drawings of like the devil.
Yeah,
and
he's really pleased about it.
It's so weird, and you can just tell that like Keith's drawn them on backstage beforehand. Like, they're just like really clumsy.
It's gonna be great, mate. Hold still.
No, you look wicked, like, honestly. It's so funny. And like, yeah, Yoko Ono in the bag.
Still didn't understand that.
Yeah, someone's playing a violin, right?
Or yeah.
And she's just like sort of moaning in the back. That's what happens, yeah.
It makes me think of I recently watched a clip of Amy Poehler and Tina Fey being on the Jimmy Fallon show, and they were playing one of the ridiculous games they play on that show where they had to say whether something was truth or a lie. And one of the things Amy Poehler had to say was that she once tried to help an old woman across the street and it turned out to be Yoko Ono. And she had to build this whole narrative around pretending this was true. It wasn't true, but... And she was like, yeah, and I felt mortified because I'd obviously like interrupted some art, and like being an old lady in like the middle of Fifth Avenue was obviously like a big thing for her, and I'm really sorry. Somehow it just made me think of that. It's like, if you found Yoko in her bag now, you'd probably like try and
help her, be like,
call her,
what's
carer
happening. Yeah, terrible. But there's loads of weird little moments like that. I don't know if you saw this part, but there's a super group that forms with John Lennon and the drummer from the Jimi Hendrix
drummer guy. The drummer guy's amazing.
He's amazing from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and Eric Clapton Clapton, and they call themselves Your Blues and Keith Richards, and it's, I loved that at the time because it just seemed so spontaneous. I'm sure it wasn't.
But there's a lot of that on YouTube. That seems to be almost like the standout,
the thing that people go back to.
Yeah,
but it's funny because it's very joyful, I think, for the Rolling Stones, because I don't know if you've heard of one of their other very famous concert films, which is much more a concert film in that it follows them around their on their actual tour and goes to their concerts, called Gimme Shelter. Mm-mm. But what it's about is they did this enormous free concert in the States. I think it was in 72 or 73. And Woodstock Hangover, they do this like big Free Love concert, and like so many more people than they expect turn up. During the space of the concert, there are four births and four deaths. Ah. And one of those deaths is like a horrible murder that happens in front of the stage. It's all, you know, happiness and light, and then a lot of it is them like dealing with the fact that this happened, and the music is getting darker and darker as well in this period. And so that for me is like what you think of when you think like, oh, the Rolling Stones. You think of, or Performance, which is a scripted film that Mick Jagger's in, that's like so much weirder than the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, but incredibly dark, whereas the Rock and Roll Circus is just like this lovely pre-lapsarian.
Yeah, it's kind of cute.
Yeah, and I love it for that. I love it for that. Would you recommend it? Yes, no,
yeah,
maybe?
I definitely would. As I say, as someone with very little knowledge of the Rolling Stones, I really enjoyed it.
All right.
So it could only be better if you knew more about them.
Good.
So for next week, I am going to recommend you a book by Diana Wynne Jones, a famed sci-fi and sort of children's author. And this book is called The Many Worlds of Christopher Chant.
Which sounds amazing. A lovely title.
It's an excellent title. I can't remember how many she wrote. It's not so much a series as she wrote several books that are set in this world. Christopher Chant, as the main character, he appears in some of them at different ages. But I think this is the only one where he's the main character. And it's a kind of multi-world story. I guess it's probably what would now be called YA, but I think it came out before that was really a publishing category. And yeah, Christopher Chant is a young boy who stuff happens to him that he can't control.
I feel like you're trying to avoid spoilers here.
Am trying to avoid spoilers. I'm also trying to make it sound too much like Harry Potter, because it's not like Harry Potter at all. But a brief outline of the plot, i.e. a boy who is magical has troubles.
Right.
It does make it sound like that.
But the puberty to boot.
The key point about it is that he lives in a world that has full knowledge of other worlds, like parallel existences. And he discovers early on that he has this pretty special ability of being able to easily travel between them, which not everybody, even if, you know, there are magicians and enchanters and stuff in his world who are very learned about the other worlds. Like, it's very weird that a small child can do this.
This sounds more His Dark Materials-y.
It definitely has elements of that as well. Yeah, and the story kind of unfolds from there. I'm not going to say much more. But yeah, and it's definitely got all of the elements that I like in a magical story.
Awesome. So that's really exciting. I can't wait to read it. And before we go, we're just gonna talk a little bit about some emails and comments and tweets, etc., etc., that we've had from you guys.
We greatly appreciate hearing from you, by the way. So all the details about how to get in touch with us are either on the website or they're at the end of the podcast. Especially when you start a podcast, it can feel a little bit like you're kind of just talking into a void.
Literally just talking in a dark basement, which is what we're
doing. Which is what we're doing right now. So we don't really know, like, is this good? Is this not good? Are you liking this? Would you like us to do more of other stuff? You know, it's really good to know. So, like, for instance, Twitter user @KnowNotThatDevlin has made us the recommendation of the TV comedy You're the Worst, which
I've never heard of it,
but I like the title, so we'll put that on the list of stuff to consider. Thank you very much. Anne Sigrid has been in touch to say she really likes the music we use, but could we please put it on the website what the songs are, so that means the music. I mean, Anna's the editor of this, I'm rubbish at this, but the music we use in between segments of the podcast,
our sort of in and out clips, so we can do that.
We can do that if that's helpful. Melanie Pilates has said that she loves the podcast. Sounds like I'm listening to girlfriends chatting over brunch.
Yeah, I just think this, we maybe should include actual brunch.
Then I should definitely
expense some brunch to be brought to our basement,
I'm sure this
please.
Can happen. And that she's making everyone listen to the Harry Potter episode, which is the main reason I included this tweet, because I feel like that's an excellent thing and more people should do that. Because our Harry Potter episode is like our proudest ever work-based achievement, I'd say.
Yeah.
And then also we had a tweet, this is a while back, so hopefully this is happening soon, from John Mannell, who works on the BBC PM programme on Radio 4, Who Killed Elsie Frost, which is a strand they're doing on his programme. And he just got in touch to say that they're working on another episode that's going to be out really soon.
So hopefully it's already out then.
Hopefully it's already out or is coming very soon. And then we also had a sort of slightly weightier contribution from Kate.
Yeah, so Kate got in touch with us just to say that she liked the show, but that she thought we were quite youth-oriented and that we could maybe like think a little bit more about the diversity of our audience and not stick so much to like teen and youth culture, which I think is a great point and one that we'll definitely think about. When we started this podcast, one of the things that we were sort of irked about as two like smart young ladies was the idea that if you're a teenage girl or a young woman, the kind of stuff that you like is considered not serious. And that was one of the sort of main ideas behind Seriously. So that is why we do have a focus on that. And also, we like that stuff. We really like it.
Yes, that's definitely right. That we kind of had a dual... We never really talked about this, actually, have we? We kind of had a dual motivation for starting the podcast. One was exactly what Anna says, that we felt like when media generally did cover, particularly British media, actually, as we've said before, like America's got far more sort of pop culture based websites that are better at this, but British media, when it does cover things that are youth or women orientated, it covers them in a slightly sneery,
it's very snarky,
superficial
and
way.
If anything is ever good, then it's like the exception that, you know, proves that everything else is crap.
I cannot even think of how many times I've tried patiently to explain to male journalists of my acquaintance that it's not cool to describe female fans as hysterical.
Yeah.
And arguing with me back that, oh, I totally use that word about boys. Like, no, you wouldn't. That's the kind of entrenched...
Yeah, literally name a time that you have.
Yeah, that we felt that we wanted to kind of just put something out there to try and redress that. And then the other half of it was we just had things we like that we want to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
The two of those things together do mean that we are pretty focused, or have been relatively focused. Hopefully some of the stuff we talked about in this week's podcast, for instance, 45 years, is way more aimed at older people.
Yeah, I think this episode we've got a good balance of stuff, so hopefully you'll like that, Kate. But in general, teenage girls are my favourite people on the planet. They're the people I care about most in this world. So yeah, sometimes I am a bit prone to like wanting to talk about those kinds
of things. But it's definitely, you are right, and it's absolutely something we want to keep thinking about.
And it's just really nice to hear from you guys and like what you would like us to talk about. So Kate, for example, has like listed a few kind of things that she'd like to hear us talk about, and that's just so nice, and we'll definitely, you know, hopefully find something new that we'd like that we might not encounter from her email. So
please send us emails. We like them. Thank you. In conclusion.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. I'm Anna.
And I'm Caroline. You can find us on iTunes.
Our Twitter is @SeriouslyPod.
And if you want to send us an email, we're seriouslypod, SRSLY, pod @gmail.com.